the dark days are done and the bright days are here. My sunny one shines so sincere. Sunny one so true.
Our next guest is one of those rare talents who has something to say and can say it funny. He's a writer-performer on the new Laugh-In and one of the most popular, outspoken, and entertaining personalities on the local news here in Los Angeles. He's won a half a dozen Emmys as a film critic and host of his own shows. Let's welcome Mr. John Barber, right over there.
Thank you, Francis. That was Sarita singing Sunny to me, accompanied by Ella Fitzgerald's favorite guitarist, Joe Pass, followed by Frank Sinatra introducing me the night he took over the Tonight Show to host it. It's Monday, September 21st, Rosh Hashanah, Jewish New Year. For those of you who understand Yiddish or Hebrew, Lashon HaTova Tikatevu. For those of you who understand English, it means may you be written in the book of life. And it being a wise ancient religion, they don't tell you if that book has a happy ending or not. I would like to dedicate this show to three fans. I never do this. The joy of doing this show for me is making people smile with a little wit or smile with wisdom. Learn from some of our guests, especially the guests tonight, whom I'll get to in a little bit, a guest who is going to tell you about the most important thing in your life, and that's the food you eat and the food that may be killing you that you don't even know about. But I find, more often, I'm the one getting the wit and wisdom and joy from the listeners or the fans. You all know, and have heard people complaining that America is not as peaceful a place, either in reality or on TV, as it was during the days of Mayberry with Andy Griffith and Don Knotts. Well, a painter in Europe, a fan by the name of Rule Smith, posted this information on my Facebook this morning that I thought I'd pass along to you. He points out that the reason Mayberry was such a peaceful place was it the dozen or so leading characters were not married? That the one character who was, Otis, was a drunk. So Rule Smith gets the first dedication. The second, the next, is to Kate O'Neill and to her father, Tally, in the Midwest. Yesterday, Kate helped her father celebrate his birthday by taking him to watch the Dallas Cowboys. Now, I gave up on football instantly last year when the NFL refused to take away the unearned Super Bowl from Tom Brady's cheating hands, proving once again that in America, the very successful who lie, cheat, and steal are never, ever punished. Bill Cosby is probably still powdering drinks, and Bush and Cheney have yet to be arrested for Iraq. Now, I seldom watch television. On weekends, mostly, it's book notes, because that's the only place you can find writers like our guest tonight, author of Altered Genes, Twisted Truth, whom I promise we'll get to soon. Other than that, it's hockey and golf, sports, the only unpredictable things on the telly. But last night, I stumbled on 60 Minutes, and I'm glad I stayed to watch. First was the president of Iran talking about how relations with the U.S. could improve, and hopefully will. As Oliver Stone said the other day, quote, Iran is no threat to anyone, but we're a threat to everyone, unquote. Now, for people, I must tell you, few of you know. And if you go to school in America, you probably do not know that Iran was once a thriving democracy in the 50s. But when Mossadegh, their democratically elected president, nationalized their oil fields Eisenhower sent in Dulles and the CIA to murder him and install our fascist Shah. And not only did Oliver Stone say this, but in 1967, at the Riverside Church in New York, and Google this astonishing speech, Martin Luther King said, "The greatest terrorist organization in the world was the United States government and the Pentagon." And a year later, they offed him. The second story on 60 Minutes was about Pope Francis. For those of you who know me, you know I am not religious in the least. I only respect and admire those whose religion improves their character and their behavior, which I must say gives me very few people to admire. On the other hand, Pope Francis, who'll be here in the United States this week speaking to Congress, seems to be the rarest pope the Vatican has seated in 1,000 years. He seems to be almost a Christian. And I trust he will speak the truth to a Congress that certainly didn't hear it from Netanyahu. Now, right now, a bunch of radicals or angelicals, radical angelicals, are running around predicting again the end of the world. For those angelicals and other religious fanatics, the world ended for you a long time ago when you stopped thinking. Now, listen, I do not swear. I have never sworn in the air. I never swear in my act. It's not becoming. But sometimes it is the best way to make a point and to tell a truth. To this end, I thank another fan for sending this quote in from Willie Nelson, who is 82 years of age. But when he turned 80, he said, "I finally outgrew my dick." I must tell you, forgive me, but funny is funny. And I'm often asked on Facebook, if I could rid the world of one thing, what would it be? Well, judging from most of the people I've met and have had to deal with, that one thing would be oxygen. Like movies, I think most people are shit. But when you run across one that is fertilizer for your soul, it makes up for all the others. I found a few in my life and many in books. And I found one in the book I have in my hands now. It's called Altered Genes, Twisted Truth. And I must tell you, it reads like a great novel that should be a film. There have been a few films like this. Aaron Brockovich in 1980, in which Julia Roberts won her Oscar and failed to thank Aaron for her life's work. That's one of those Hollywood shits. The other film, Karen Silkwood, where Meryl Streep played the young woman who exposed the wrongdoing of the McKee-Kerr nuclear facility and was murdered, with her family suing and winning. Well, in this terrific read, the author sued the Federal Drug Administration on our behalf and uncovered a nest of corrupt cockroaches and scientists. Oops, I repeat myself. Aside from being thankful for the book, with a wonderful preface by Jane Goodall, I am immediately a fan of someone who, against his will, became an activist. Red Fox, my best friend in shows business, used to say, "Heroes ain't born, they're cornered." The author, my guest, is a public interest attorney who was cornered by two things, and lucky for us, he was cornered by his conscience and the truth. Ladies and gentlemen, Steve Drucker. Steve, thank you. Thank you so much for being here. And I must tell you again, your book was a whole lot better and more compelling, a page turner, I must say, than I thought when I picked it up. And congratulations on it.
Well, thank you very much, John. I appreciate the kind words, and I appreciate being a guest on your program.
Well, I mentioned to you when I said hello earlier, I hate to ask this question because I'm tired of asking it, but often it elicits such interesting answers to me and to the listeners to know a little bit about where Steve came from. Where were you born? What was your family like? Do you have siblings? Where did you go to school? Did you want to play for the Yankees as a kid? And how did you become an attorney?
I grew up in Des Moines, Iowa, and I had an older sister, two younger brothers, went through elementary, junior high, and high school in Des Moines. Then I rooted for the Yankees, but I don't know if I ever really wanted to play for them because I think I even back then realized that was an unrealistic wish. I went to university at University of California, Berkeley, majored in philosophy, and then went on to Berkeley's law school. And when I went to law school, it's interesting. I wasn't sure if I wanted to go to law school. I had several different options that I was considering. When I finally decided to go to law school, it was because I did have a thought that I might be able to use that legal training to do some very important public interest work. I wasn't sure what it would be, but that was the feeling that I had. And interestingly, it took many years before I actually got involved in that case. Really, that was the reason I went to law school. I just didn't realize it until many years later, and I've been involved in it, as you said, somewhat reluctantly, having become an activist and having begun a lawsuit against the Food and Drug Administration.
Why did you pick Berkeley? Was that at the height of the free speech movement with Mario Savio, or later than that?
No, actually, it was the free speech movement was my first year. So I was a freshman in 1964. And
you know,
so coming from Iowa, I had wanted a major change. That's one reason I went to Berkeley. It was a bit more change than I had expected, and it was exciting, but it was also, you know, there was so much going on at Berkeley, so it took a while to assess it and assort it, and I don't like joining crowds and movements, so I generally hang back a bit and assess things and try to make up my own mind and not just go with the crowd because that's what the crowd's doing.
They were indeed very heady and newsmaking days. My first publicist was a fellow named Joe Sigmund, and he was very possessive of his son, and he wanted his son to go to a law school. And I thought, well, he'll probably go to UCLA where he can see him every day. He said, no, I wanted to send him to Berkeley. And I said, why would you want him to go to Berkeley? I thought you wanted to see him every day. He said, I will on the news. but anyway, I was enraptured, first of all, by Jane Goodall's so thoughtful introduction to your book. How did you happen to meet Jane? What is your association with her? And how did she come to be involved with your book and your work?
Right. Actually, just as a specific point, she wrote the foreword to my book. I actually wrote the introduction. It was a great good fortune that that Jane Goodall was brought into my life and my book was brought to her attention. And it was through a mutual friend of ours, a good friend of mine, who is the president of a really wonderful foundation named Pax Natura, which is wonderful environmental work. He has on his board several eminent people, including Jane Goodall, Desmond Tutu, Oscar Arias, a couple other Nobel Peace laureates, I believe. So Jane Goodall has been very concerned about GMOs for many years. She's mentioned it in at least, I think, the last two books she's written, and I think even the last three. But her most recent book is on the plant world, and she was writing a chapter in that book on genetically engineered foods. And my friend heard that she wanted to find somebody good to review that chapter, make sure that it was tight, and so he put her in touch with me, and after I'd reviewed her chapter and sent her suggestions, he had told her I was writing a book, and she wanted to see it, and I sent her the first eight chapters, which is what I had done then, and after she'd read them, the email she sent me had some of the main statements that are in her foreword, calling it without doubt one of the most important books of the last 50 years, calling me a great hero.
and she did suggest, also saying
it was one of the most chilling books she's written as well.
Well, that indeed it is. I mean, it's a great detective story almost. And she did suggest you deserve a Nobel Prize. And well, indeed, you certainly deserve it a lot more than the occupant of the White House. Now, the next thing that captured my imagination, because I love this kind of thing that happens to people who reluctantly are cornered by the truth of what they discover, and they're the only ones that can pursue it. And your introduction was how I reluctantly became an activist. And what we're going to do for this hour, Steve, because your book is so well crafted with each chapter leading to the next chapter, we're going to try to go through it chapter by chapter. So tell us how you reluctantly became the activist that took on these giant manufacturers and the federal government.
Well, it was, as the introduction relates, in early 1996, I became concerned about genetically engineered foods. Actually, I heard about them for the first time in late 1995 and was quite surprised that I hadn't heard about them before then,
second,
and most
Steve,
people didn't seem to know about them.
Interrupted for just a second. Genetically engineered foods, or genetically modified, or whatever they're called, everybody considers it an evil, but my feeling is because of 6 or 8 billion people being on the planet, one of the major problems will be to feed them. Is it not possible that some scientist started this pursuit with this in mind, which is to help humanity and not hinder it?
Well, several of the scientists who've been involved in genetic engineering, even before it expanded into agriculture, definitely had altruistic motives as well. There have also been conflicts of interest in terms of financial interest on the part of many scientists. But clearly there have been scientists who have had, who believe that this technology, especially when applied to agriculture, is going to be able to have significant benefits. And in fact, that's one of the problems. People who get enthusiastic about what they're doing, think that it's going to be great, can sometimes become blinded to its downsides and even begin and go down that slippery slope of adopting a philosophy that the ends justify the means. And because many of the scientists felt they were pursuing lofty ends, they allowed themselves progressively to slip further into not only spin doctrine, but then spin doctrine that eventually shaded into a misrepresentation, and then in some cases outright lying, and often without realizing, I think, how seriously they were distorting the truth and misleading people. Because scientists, as anybody, but scientists, I think, are particularly prone to feeling somewhat pompous about their knowledge and their expertise, and that other people are ignorant, and that they have the knowledge, and they don't want to let ignorant emotional responses deprive the world of something beautiful that they've spent many years trying to develop. And so there has clearly been a significant component of arrogance on the part of many scientists and scientific institutions. And we often hear that, well, the opposition to genetically engineered foods is just based upon ignorance. If it were based upon ignorance, then there would not have been such a systematic, protracted endeavor to actually suppress the evidence, keep
but
the facts from the public,
twist
the facts. And my book documents solidly that that has happened year after year. So that gives the lie to their argument that they really want people to understand the facts. They actually want to twist the facts and bury key facts.
Well, Steve, this probably wasn't your intent when you began your research and investigation into this field. What were you looking for when you started? I mean, Were you looking for something bad? Were you looking for something good? Or were you just looking for facts and information? And what were the first startling things that you uncovered that told you there's a whole lot more to this than we're being told?
Well, initially, I wanted to get the facts. I had heard, one definitely hears the claims of all the benefits that are supposed to accrue and how safe and dandy all of these are. But I'd heard a few people that I respect, scientists, issuing cautions. And so I decided, again, to start doing research and trying to learn the facts and assess them for myself. And the more I learned, the more I became concerned.
What were some of the benefits that they bragged about? Did they brag about the fact that this will it will kill bugs or will prevent bugs from eating the plants? What were they saying on the positive side, and then what was happening in reality?
Well, one of the big claims was that, this technology is, when applied to agricultural plants, is going to boost yields, and that was one of the many promises that really has not accrued. The genetic engineering process itself has not unlocked the potential to dramatically or even significantly increase yields. In fact, the most widely planted genetically engineered crop for many of the first years was demonstrated by university scientists at the University of Nebraska to actually be reducing the yield, and it was the genetic, and they could pinpoint that a significant percentage of that yield reduction was attributable to the genetic manipulation itself. So that showed the most widely planted at that point genetically engineered crop in the world had been demonstrated by independent scientists to actually be having a yield decrease. But that didn't stop the industry and the proponents from claiming that they were increasing yields. So that's just par for the course, that the evidence, the science, the evidence, if it goes against genetic engineering, then it's either attacked and twisted or suppressed. People
you
just
have,
won't hear about it.
You have this information now. Then if you have this information, you must have thought, I have to take this information to organizations that are much more powerful than I am. Did you try to go that route, and why did they not take action?
I did initially, when I had learned enough to realize that there really were legitimate reasons to be concerned about the safety of these foods, and when I knew learned that the FDA had made a presumption that they could all be regarded as safe and that they could all be on the market without any safety testing whatsoever, and that is what the FDA continues to allow. No safety testing whatsoever is required from the side of the FDA, and that they weren't even requiring labels to at least give the consumers the opportunity to understand that they're which foods had been genetically reconfigured so they could opt out if they wanted to, I decided there should be a lawsuit. And because I had not at that point been practicing, been doing much litigation and was not really practicing law actively and was involved in another important project, I started contacting organizations that I thought would naturally want to bring such a lawsuit and would have the expertise and the resources to do it. But for one or another reason, there was general enthusiasm about the idea of a lawsuit against the FDA, but none of them felt prepared to do it for one or another reason. And they all thought I was actually going to do it until I said, no, I'm calling to try to convince you to do it, and then they would try to convince me that they couldn't do it. So after several rounds of this, it became clear that if I didn't bring the lawsuit, it probably wasn't going to happen, at least not in the near future. So I just put aside the important project I was working on and founded the nonprofit organization, the Alliance for Biointegrity, and started moving ahead full speed to organize the lawsuit.
To this end, the first thing you must have thought of is the enormous cost to you of doing this, and where would those funds come from? And the reaction from your immediate family and friends about, my God, you're trying to take on the federal government?
Well, fortunately, I was just thinking of the goal, and it is interesting. From the beginning, I just didn't let restrictive thoughts get in my way. I felt very strongly from the beginning some kind of deep responsibility to do something based on what I had learned, and I just felt that something had to be done. And since I couldn't convince groups that did have the resources to do it, I just decided I'm going to move ahead, and I'll hope that resources gather as they can. But I was able to, within the first few months, raise some money that was able to pay the salary of an assistant for a while. I didn't draw a salary, and to pay a retainer for a public interest law firm that heard about my plans for the suit and wanted to be involved and be the attorneys of record. And I just kept moving ahead, and a lot of it was done on a shoestring. But
when you presented your brief or your case,
most of it was done on a shoestring.
when you went to court for the first time, or you served the papers for the first time, what did you feel, and what was the reaction of the recipients at the FDA over this guy's coming here trying to sue us?
Well, I think the biggest jolt was the biggest surge was when we actually filed the lawsuit officially, which occurred in late May of 1998. The lawsuit was filed in federal district court in the District of Columbia, and there was a major press conference that was held announcing the lawsuit at the National Press Club in Washington that day, and one of the powerful features, dramatic features of the lawsuit was that among the plaintiff group, the individuals and organizations that had signed on to the complaint and were actually suing the FDA were 9 well-qualified life scientists. And one of them was a professor of molecular and cellular biology at the University of California, Berkeley. One was with the Northwestern University Medical School. He actually used genetic engineering regularly in trying to cure human genetic defects. But when he met with me in Chicago,
didn't some religious leaders also join in supporting the suit?
Yes, there were several religious leaders, individuals, ordained clergy from several Christian denominations, three rabbis, Orthodox, Conservative, and Reform. There was a Hindu religious organization from Chicago. There was the chancellor of a Buddhist university who objected, and they all objected to consuming genetically engineered foods on the basis of religious principle. And this was to consuming the foods in general. Even the rabbis were not just saying, we're afraid of... Excuse me?
Was that religious principle based on the fact that they felt it was not grown by nature or God?
Well, it wasn't quite that. It was based on what they understood about the radical and random way in which genetic engineering was being used to intervene into genomes that had developed through natural processes, and that they felt were ultimately through the intelligent operation of God, that the genetic engineering represented an irreverent trespass into the integrity of God's creation. And so that was the basis, that these foods represented an irreverent, and they didn't believe that humans shouldn't have the right to do selective breeding and develop different varieties of crops. They did believe that. They believed that genetic engineering was far different than any of the breeding techniques that had been developed beforehand, and that it had crossed a boundary that should not have been crossed, and that it did represent an irreverent trespass into the integrity of God's creation.
And obviously you must have discovered, or you wouldn't have filed the suit, did you discover many negative effects on human beings or animals from ingesting genetically engineered crops or food?
Well, the proponents of these foods routinely claim there's not any evidence that a single product of genetic engineering has ever harmed a human being. And that's just not true at all. In 1989 and 1990, in the book, there's a whole chapter in the book devoted to this.
That's the chapter, Disappearing a Disaster. It's stunning.
Right, Disappearing a Disaster, Chapter 3. There was a major epidemic that swept through the United States that was caused by not only a genetically engineered product, but it was the very first one that came on the market, the very first ingestible product of genetic engineering that came to market, caused a major epidemic. It killed dozens of Americans. It seriously sickened between 4,000 and 5,000, according to the most recent estimate of the Center for Disease Control. And hundreds of those that were stricken who weren't killed are invalids to this very day. Their lives are very, very seriously impaired because they ingested a product of genetic engineering.
And specific product
And it was a genetically engineered supplement of the essential amino acid L-tryptophan. L-tryptophan is safe. L-tryptophan is one of the amino acids that we need. Our bodies don't synthesize it, though. We need to get it from our food, or in cases where people wanted more of it because it has many beneficial effects, they were taking supplements. And for many years, millions of people around the world were taking L-tryptophan supplements with no problems at all. But the very first supplement that was produced from genetically engineered bacteria instead of the normal bacteria that had not been genetically engineered, that caused the major epidemic.
And do you know the company that produced
that there
it?
Were
The name of the company that produced it, do you know?
Oh, the name of the particular company was Showa Denko, a Japanese company. All of the major companies that were producing L-tryptophan at that time were based in Japan, but only Showa Denko altered the manufacturing process.
These supplements were approved by the FDA. How long did your suit take? And as you were gaining ground, were you surprised that it kept going through the system and not being tossed out? But as you were going through the ground, did other scientists begin to support you, or did they begin to denigrate you for what you were trying to do?
Well, it depends. The scientists who have actually endeavored to learn the facts have been very supportive. Many scientists who have been badly misled by the scientists who do understand what genetic engineering is and do understand a lot of the facts and have been covering them up, they themselves are confused and they want to be on the side of science, and they often take they just say, well, if the other scientists say it's safe, then we're not going to object or stand up, and they tend to tacitly go along. And, of course, scientists who have a big stake in it, either psychologically, monetarily, or both, often attack not only me, but almost any person who is bringing out evidence that goes against genetic engineering, because
suit take? And when you won the suit, were you surprised? And how many thousands of pages of documents did the FDA have to turn over to you, and how on earth did you go through all that material? And when you went through that material, what were some of the most disturbing things that you uncovered about the system of approving our foods?
Yes. Well, as you mentioned, the lawsuit very quickly obtained a major effect because it forced the FDA to turn over all of its internal files relevant to the policy it had made on genetically engineered foods. So, as you said, we got over 44,000 pages, we meaning I and the legal team, of internal files from the Food and Drug Administration. I took responsibility for researching those files, going through them. It was a major job. It took a long time. Now, fortunately, there was a basic kind of overview index that was given, and in skimming through them, one could often realize that certain pages were not going to be relevant. But even with that, going through all the memos or letters that could be relevant and actually reading them carefully to try to make sure that I wasn't missing anything did take a long time. It was a big dedication, but I wanted to do it and do it thoroughly. And that thorough search paid off because I discovered that the FDA had impaneled the biotechnology task force composed of key scientists from the major divisions, scientific divisions within the FDA that really needed to, their perspective needed to be taken. They needed to be involved in the assessment of genetically engineered foods. And overwhelmingly, all of these memos coming from experts in the diverse branches, microbiology, toxicology, Center for Veterinary Medicine, Center for Special Research Skills, they all were stating that the viewpoint that genetic engineering is different than conventional breeding, that the products it produces cannot be just presumed to be as safe as their conventionally produced counterparts, and that they need to be put through rigorous testing. And what happened is that none of that information made it into public. The FDA administrators, or at least those who were making the decisions in this case, had opted to follow a promotional directive from the White House that was first issued in 1986 by the Reagan White House to promote as much as possible the biotechnology industry. And that was renewed during the first Bush administration, which is when this FDA policy was released. So the FDA in public in May of 1992, when it stated its policy, claimed that it was not aware of any information showing that foods produced through these new methods differed in any uniform or meaningful way from other foods. Well, their files had memo after memo from their own experts explaining, giving them information why these foods were different, why they could not be presumed safe, why they had to be tested. And so the FDA's official statement is basically a lie. I mean, it's just contradicted by the evidence within the FDA's own files. It's very hard to regard it as anything but a deliberate deception. And so pervasive was the opinion among the FDA experts that these foods are different and entail different risks, that an FDA official whose job it was to review all of the input coming from the scientists wrote a very strong memo to the FDA's biotechnology coordinator a few months before the agency's policy was issued, complaining that the FDA, in the policy statement that she could see was being developed, was trying to force a square peg into a round hole by trying to force an ultimate conclusion that genetic engineering is essentially the same as traditional breeding. And then she stated, "The processes of genetic engineering and traditional breeding are different, and according to the technical experts in the agency, they lead to different risks." So that shows Steve, you how Steven, pervasive.
Stephen, is aspartame a genetically engineered product, or is it a chemical product? Because I remember the Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, who was Reagan's Secretary of Defense and a very close friend of Saddam Hussein, who signed a contract with Saddam to sell them gas, which they used against Iranians and the Kurds. But he was the lawyer for the company that made aspartame, and two or three times the Federal Drug Administration refused to grant that a license to sell it to the public, and then suddenly Rumsfeld's in the White House, and it is approved. How does that happen? And is that what happened with these genetically modified foods you're talking about?
That, I believe, is a different case, and I have to kind of beg off on answering that one, because I just haven't been focused in studying that particular additive. I've been focused on the genetically engineered foods, which contain additives that are presumed unsafe by law, but the FDA has actually presumed to be generally recognized as safe, even though it knew that even within its own scientific branch, they were not recognized as safe, and that the overwhelming
opinion of its own scientific branch was that they can't be presumed safe. Stephen, what you're telling us basically is that this is not a scientific judgment. This is a political judgment.
Correct, political and economically driven judgment. It is not based in science at all, nor is it even based in the law, because if the FDA's policy had been based in the law, every one of these foods would have been required to go through testing and be demonstrated safe before it came to market. The FDA science policy violates science, and it violates the law as well.
Okay, now we get to the stage where it is approved by the Federal Drug Administration, and in this terrific, again, another terrific chapter, it's Chapter 5, it's called Illegal Entry. How did these foods get into our marketplace? How did these foods spread around the world?
Well, the question how they got into our marketplace is, as I mentioned, the FDA basically ignored the warnings of its own scientists, covered them up, and lied about them. And then it gave the industry free rein to introduce any genetically engineered foods onto our market. I should say, actually dump them onto our market without doing one iota of safety testing ahead of time. So, and that is still the case in the U.S. The FDA does not impose one mandatory requirement upon the biotechnology industry when it comes to genetically engineered foods. In fact, according to the FDA, a manufacturer can dump GMOs on our market and doesn't even have to tell the FDA ahead of time it's going to do it, or tell the FDA after the fact that it's done it. That's how completely minimal the FDA's regulation is. There's no regulation of the biotechnology industry from the side of the FDA right now,
although they try to pretend that they're doing something. Stephen, you must have been outraged, absolutely outraged, by what it was you were discovering and how it was getting into the marketplace. So with this information that you had, since you had no organizations helping you, did you try to approach the Washington Times, or did you try to approach the New York Times or the LA Times or the major networks to give them this information so that they could tell
us? There was a major attempt to, once I decided to make public the documents in the FDA file that the FDA had suppressed and basically fibbed about, I was featured at a major press conference in June of 1999 in Washington, D.C., at which I announced and explained what the FDA science had actually said and how the FDA decision makers had buried their warnings and then told the exact opposite, said the exact opposite in public, and how the law had been broken. And there were representatives from major news magazines and major newspapers there, and many of them wanted me to get them copies of those memos, which I did, but then no reports came out in the media one way or the other. Editors or people higher up must have suppressed all of that because it didn't come out. And that is a story. If that had been story about some scandal of some celebrity, it would have been everywhere. But this was about
maybe if Bill Cosby had given his girls some genetically modified food, we would have heard about it.
I hate my book documents one of the most frightening episodes. Oh, I'm sorry. Are you asking me a question?
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
Okay. As my book documents, one of the most actually frightening and I think also very, very discouraging examples of media cover-up and self-censorship when it comes to risks of genetically engineered foods involves the Washington Post, which, as most people will remember, played the key role in exposing the Watergate, the Watergate break-in and the cover-up from the White House, and that they so the Washington Post actually in uncovering the cover-up, and they pride themselves on the courage they showed in the investigative reporting then. Well, one of their main reporters who reported on science and biotechnology issues had come to that press conference. He got copies of the key documents from me. He interviewed several scientist plaintiffs in our lawsuit, and he was planning to do a major expose. But finally, when his article was published, there was no expose of the food safety issue at all. And the only scientists who were talking about the food safety issue were the proponents of these foods, saying how safe they are and how there wasn't any scientific question about them. I couldn't believe it. But before I could call him to say what was going on, he called me to apologize and told me that the article that was published was not the article he had initially written. He had written a hard-hitting exposé, but his editor would not let it in, and his editor forced all of the powerful quotes from the FDA memos and all of the other really evidence that would have concerned the public. They cleaned it out of that article before the article was printed. So that was self-censorship exercised on the part of the Washington Post, when back in the Nixon era, threats from the Nixon administration couldn't deter them from publishing, continuing to publish the Woodward and Bernstein exposés. But here, with no threat from the government, the Washington Post censored itself and would not let the public read about this important information that was suppressed.
Stephen,
that's how bad it has been with the mainstream American media.
Stephen, a personal question for you and your family. What foods do you eat, and what foods do you avoid?
I try to avoid all genetically engineered foods, which in the United States is quite a difficult task, unfortunately. But I try to do it rigorously because I figure I don't want to ingest these products. I know too much about the risks. Secondly, if I don't do it, who will? But it is difficult. But fortunately, it's becoming easier in some ways. Any food that's certified organic is supposed to be free of GMOs, so that's a safer bet. And then within recent years, there's been an independent certification program that actually does do testing and careful analysis of the history of a food. And if foods go through this process and win the seal of approval, the non-GMO project verification, so little seal non-GMO project verified, they can be confident that there's no significant presence of products from genetically engineered foods in that product. Now, the Congress of the United, at least the House of Representatives in July, just voted on a bill that if it gets passed through the Senate and signed into law, will actually take away the opportunity of independent organizations such as that to continue certifying non-GMO. That's how threatened they are by the prospect of the American public actually being able to have an informed choice when it comes to GMOs. But I would say try to avoid GMOs. It's good to go organic anyway because they're just, as we know, there's a fairly heavy use of herbicides, other kinds of pesticides, and increasing research is pointing the finger of doubt as to whether all of these chemical additives are safe. In fact, the most widely used herbicide in the world, which the active ingredient is glyphosate, just a few months ago, a special panel from the United Nations Health Organization came out with a statement that, based on extensive data that they've been reviewing, that glyphosate is a probable human carcinogen. And the state of California has just gone further than that and not just called it a probable carcinogen, but has labeled it as a carcinogen, a human carcinogen. And,
Stephen, what foods do you eat and do you encourage your family to eat? Just organic?
Well, I try to stay organic, as I said, as much as possible. It's not always possible, especially when I'm traveling. But I tend to favor fresh vegetables, fresh fruits, whole grains. At least for me, I don't have problems eating grains, and I find them very nourishing. But I know that many people are concerned about them or find that they're problematic. So I don't have an official position on that. I just know that I can eat grains. And,
are you encouraged by the fact that there have been a half a dozen countries around the world who have begun burning down these GMO crops and not allowing them in their country? The Soviet Union, for example, won't have GMOs in their country.
Yeah, the countries that are actually now coming out with official policies that will prevent the planting of GMOs in their country, and there are a few major countries in the European Union, and there appears that there will be more. That is a good sign. They're just, the governments are saying, we are not going to allow the planting of genetically engineered crops on our fields. I think that's very smart, and that's going to really increase the value of their crops, because there won't be danger of contamination from genetically engineered crops as there is in the U.S. Even organic crops have been contaminated by genetically engineered crops being grown within, you know, a mile or two.
What about the hay and the wheat and the grasses that the pigs and the cows and the sheep eat in this country? If they are, do they have
most
a negative
a very large percentage of that?
I beg your pardon?
A very large percentage of the feed that is consumed by the farm animals in our country, and also in the European Union, I have to add, is from comprised of genetically engineered plants. And the food, one of the memos that was suppressed, one of the memos from the Food and Drug Administration that speaks directly to that point was written by the director of the FDA Center for Veterinary Medicine, who stated that he and the other scientists at that division, and that's a big division, felt that there were risks involved if farm animals were fed high concentrations of genetically engineered foods during their lifespan before they were slaughtered or just before being milked or before their eggs were gathered. Because
at the top of the show I mentioned, really, this book of yours. First of all, tell people how they can get it, and I would encourage them to get it. It is so interesting and so meaningful, and as Jane Goodall said, one of the best books in 50 years, and this man deserves a Nobel Prize. How can they get it? Can they get it at Amazon? How did they do that?
Thank you. Well, it is available on Amazon as in hardcover, softcover, as a Kindle, and also as an audiobook for those that want to either just listen alone or to be able to read and then listen. It's also available as an audio. It's also available through Barnes & Noble bookstores and many independent bookstores. Altered Genes, Twisted Truth, How the Venture to Genetically Engineer Our Food Has Subverted Science, Corrupted Government, and Systematically Deceived the Public. But the main title is the one to remember, Altered Genes, Twisted Truth.
It is so effective a title. At the top of the show in the introduction, I mentioned it should be a film. Have you ever thought of making it a documentary? And there have been a couple of very successful documentaries made on a shoestring, that's Gasland, about fracking. And then I think some Englishman made a great documentary about how they're making us fat because of the food they feed us in fast foods restaurants. Have you thought of having this made as a documentary?
Yes, I have, and several people have, and of course I've appeared as an interviewee in several documentaries, but several people now really feel that this book provides enough ground for a couple different documentaries. And I've been discussing, there's some documentary filmmakers who are seriously considering it. So it is being considered. I think it should happen. I think it probably will happen. I think there may be more than one documentary that are really based.
Have you ever approached Frontline at PBS? Have you ever approached Ken Burns?
Not directly yet, but hopefully that will happen.
Well, I would hope that Ken would take on something like this. I mean, his Americana stuff is really interesting, but actually it's Powder Puff stuff.
Yes.
And Frontline does do some interesting stuff. Of course, they stay away from more controversial material. But I must tell you, Stephen, you have done an absolutely wonderful public service, and I appreciate the fact that you took out this hour. And you notice I didn't have one interruption or one call, because I had the feeling that you had so much to say and should not be interrupted. Thank you again for being here, and I would urge everyone for a great read, even though it's science. It is just a terrific courtroom drama. Stephen, thank you so much, and you have a wonderful night.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Stephen. Good night. Good night, everyone. We'll see you in 2 weeks.
You're my spark of nature's fire. You're my sweet, complete desire. A sunny, 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 I love you.